Okay, shall we crack on with proceedings? Hello, everybody. Hello. I guess I'll briefly sort of introduce myself. I'm Katie Forsyth, so I'm a teaching fellow in the English department, specifically in medieval and early modern literature. I have done work on Milton. I guess Milton is a sort of secondary research interest. My primary research is on Reformation kind of book history, mid-16th century, kind of the business of printing books, and the kind of the politics and the kind of religious aspect behind printing. But also have a kind of strong interest in Milton, hence why I'm here tonight. So I think you're obviously kind of familiar with the setup of things, so I'm going to talk for between 50 minutes and an hour, depending on how quickly I speak. And then we'll have a tea break, and then we'll have a sort of a seminar situation where we talk about the things that I can set for you to read. Okay? Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So today we have, in my opinion, the enjoyable task of thinking about the 17th century poet and polemicist John Milton and his relationship with the ancient world. As you know, I'm going to spend the first half of the session giving a lecture on Milton and the ancient world before we come together in a seminar scenario to talk through Milton's two shorter poems, L'Allegro and Il Penseroso, and the opening of Milton's famous epic poem, Paradise Lost, alongside of a number of other classical epic openings from Homer and Virgil. So, I decided to treat this lecture as an introduction to Milton, his life, his work, and the historical context in which he was writing, as well as using it to give you some introductory information about the two different bits of Milton's poetry that we're going to focus on in the second half of this evening. So broadly speaking, the lecture falls into three parts. Firstly, a biographical section on Milton himself from birth to death. Secondly, an introduction to Milton's earlier poetry, and finally a section on Paradise Lost and the ancient and classical tradition. So hopefully by the end of the lecture you're going to feel a bit more grounded in who Milton was, what his intentions were as a writer, both for poetry and prose, and how Milton used and reinterpreted the ancient world in his writing. So all of this will be of use for us, hopefully, to take forward into the seminar after the tea break. Okay. So, let's start with Milton and some biography. So Milton was born on Friday the 9th of December 1608 at the house at the Sign of the Spread Eagle in Bread Street in London. He was the second surviving child of the scrivener, so a professional scribe, John Milton, and his wife Sarah. Milton was born into an affluent mercantile household, and his childhood was filled with music and learning. His father, alongside his professional duties as a scrivener, had a passion for music and wrote numerous pieces of music for sacred use within a domestic setting. And he was keen for the young Milton to have an extensive and thorough education. Milton's education began at home, and as the eminent Milton academics Gordon Campbell and Thomas N. Corns point out in their seminal biography of Milton, his writing reveals that his father, so Milton's father, paid for lessons in Greek, Latin, Hebrew, French, and Italian. And whilst, quote, Milton went on to study the ancient languages at school, modern languages were not taught in schools, and it seems likely that all of Milton's instruction in French and Italian, and possibly Spanish, was given in the domestic setting. Indeed, later in 1644, after he'd worked as a tutor to his two young nephews, Milton composed a pamphlet called Of Education that laid out the impressive educational programme that he thought fitting for young boys. He noted the importance of learning a wide variety of languages, so Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, Syriac, and the only modern language to get a mention was Italian, which Milton sort of flippantly stated could easily be learned at any odd hour. So that gives you a sense of kind of Milton's learning, shall we say. So whilst many people did learn lots of modern languages, so to speak, the primary focus in an affluent young man's education were the classics, the classical languages. And in his poem from the 1630s, Ad Patrem, so to my father, Milton expressed thanks to his father for paying for lessons in Latin, Greek, Hebrew, French and Italian before he even went to school. So we're not 100% certain when Milton moved from private tutoring at home to becoming a pupil at St Paul's School, and various academics have debated whether Milton joined in the third form at 11 or perhaps at 13. But whatever, he went to the prestigious, or whenever, he went to the prestigious St Paul's School in London, which gained its reputation in the early modern period thanks to the work of the humanist John Collett, who took on the leadership of the school, rebuilding and revamping it with help from the great humanist thinker Erasmus. The school reopened in 1509, and with, quote, within Collett's lifetime, St Paul's became one of the most important schools in England. So, as you may know, the school sort of sprawls now next to the Thames in Barnes, but when Milton attended, it was a one-room school very close to his house on Bread Street, so in central London. Students didn't pay to attend, but they had to bring their own candles, and they had to be capable of reading and writing in Latin before they joined. I think it's very easy to forget, or not even be aware of, the extensive and rigorous education that boys received in the early modern period. And I think that's something that really fuels the flames of kind of the Shakespeare authorship debate. People fail to realise the extensive and detailed education that Shakespeare had at the Grammar School in Stratford. And the education of Milton, the education he received, surpassed even that of Shakespeare. St Paul's School, governed and influenced by some of the greatest humanist thinkers of the Renaissance, was one of the finest educational establishments in the country, and as Gregory Chaplin exclaims of Erasmus, but more specifically to St Paul's, of Collett and its first master, William Lilly, I'm quoting, as great Renaissance humanists, their principal goal was the preparation of young men for public life through the study of classical languages and literature, which meant the studia humanitatis, so the humanities, grammar, rhetoric, poetry, history, moral philosophy. And from the outset, Erasmus writes, which provides a theoretical framework for the education of St Paul's, and I'm quoting Erasmus now, boys must be instructed in Greek, of course, and Latin, because almost everything worth learning is set forth in these two languages. Such education in classical languages and literature from a variety of genres formed eloquent and morally well-rounded young men for a lifetime of service within the public sphere. And various academics have put together a picture of the kind of material that Milton would have studied and progressed through during his time at St Paul's. So Campbell and Corns, in their biography, have put together a nice picture of the classical material that Milton would have been exposed to during his school education. Can you actually see? Can you see the PowerPoint?
Yes.
So, the third form, so whether he's at school at this stage or whether he's being tutored at home, he's still receiving this, this kind of information. He would have built on his Latin grammar. He would have started conversational Latin via the works of Erasmus, the comedies of Terence, and studied Ovid's Tristia. Then at 12, he will have studied more poetry, started to read history. He would have read kind of Ovid's Metamorphoses and Epistles, and he would have read Caesar for history. So we know Milton had a private tutor at this time. He was called Thomas Young. And as I've said, it's uncertain whether he was taught both at school during the day and at home in the evenings, or whether he was just taught privately at home at this time. But as I've said, whatever, Milton will have covered that information that I've already mentioned. At 13, he'd have definitely been at St Paul's. He looked at Sallust's histories, Virgil's eclogues, and began studying Greek. At 14, you start to look at the biblical Greek of the New Testament, as well as Cicero and Martial and more Virgil for Latin. At 15, you add additional Greek dialects, and you read the relevant literature from those dialects, so Theocritus in Doric, Hesiod in Ionic, and in Latin he would have read Horace and continued to build on his reading of Cicero. At 16, he studied Hebrew and he read even more widely in Greek literature, so Homer, Euripides, Isocrates, Demosthenes, and in Latin he would have read the satirists, and his history reading would have been undertaken in Greek at that point. So, quite exhaustive education, and building year on year, very extensively. But not only was he kind of taught to read these texts, kind of literally kind of understand them in Latin or Greek or Hebrew, but he was also taught to analyse their construction as examples of key literary genres, particularly in respect to their style and their linguistic composition. So as Chaplin explains, Milton would have devoted considerable time to analysing literary models, identifying the grammatical, rhetorical, prosodic and logical principles of the texts he was studying, and translating, memorising, paraphrasing and imitating these models. Something strange for us today is the extent to which imitation was encouraged and seen as a key way in the early modern period, as a key way in which you compose literature. You imitated, you tried to emulate and surpass the original work in that imitation. Equally, Milton would have had an excellent grasp of language and form, so he would regularly be expected to double translate, so turn something in Latin into English and then translate it back again into Latin. He would also have translated Greek or Hebrew into English and then into Latin, so he could translate across multiple languages. And he would have been required to translate across poetic and literary forms as well. So turning poetry into prose and back again, or poetry from one metrical form into another. A kind of caveat to all of this is that whilst Erasmus said that everything worth reading was written in the classical languages, so Greek or Latin, it's important to note that Milton's headmaster, Alexander Gill, also had an interest in and passion for vernacular poetry. And I think that's an important point to have in the back of your mind when we turn to sort of after the break to look at Paradise Lost and think about that as an English epic poem. Okay, so from St Paul's, Milton went to Christ's College, one of 16 colleges then at the University of Cambridge. Cambridge was traditionally the more religiously radical of the two universities, so key thinking surrounding the English Reformation took place in pubs and various houses around Cambridge. And it's important to note that each Cambridge college had its own distinct religious stance, so some would be far more reformed and radically Protestant than others. And choosing where you went to university in the 17th century was quite different to the choices that students make today. So, firstly, there were only two universities in England to choose from. So you went to Cambridge or you went to Oxford. Secondly, the choice was generally made by the father rather than by the son. And the choice was made by a consideration of who the best tutor for your son would be. Who would be best to guide his intellectual and his spiritual, that's very important, his spiritual development. So consequently, you ended up at a university and then a college within that university as a sort of byproduct of ultimately who your family wanted you to be tutored by. And Milton's father chose a man called William Chappell, who happened to be at Christ's. And Milton spent a great deal of time with Chappell. Students and tutors all lived in the same room, the same chamber. Milton would have shared a bed with his fellow students and with Chappell. So a very kind of intense academic experience. But studying at Cambridge meant different things for different people. So more aristocratic students generally never kind of took or graduated from their degree. So they went to expand their horizons, to sort of see and be seen a little bit, and to sort of finish off their education. Other students like Milton took studying very seriously and would be pushed accordingly. And the 1570 statute of Cambridge University stated that, and I quote, "The first years shall teach rhetoric, the second and third logic, the fourth shall add philosophy." And like at St Paul's, Milton's education comprised an extensive amount of reading of classical works that encompass subjects such as history, mathematical science, logic, and Roman law. So within that, eloquence and the forming of arguments was key, and Milton was required to debate and form rhetorical speeches as part of his education. Indeed, Milton's prolusions, so speeches made in Latin that made up part of his degree, they survive and give us an insight into the sorts of activities that Milton was required to undertake when he was at Cambridge. But it's thought that Milton most likely fell out with William Chappell, and he had a period of time away from Cambridge in the kind of in the 1620s. But he did return in October 1627, and he worked with a new tutor. He stayed on in 1629 to study for his MA. I don't know if anyone knows, but Cambridge students who have had an undergraduate degree from Cambridge don't actually work for their MA now. They sort of have to just stay out of trouble for, I'm not sure, 3-4 years, and then they're sort of awarded it. They go back for another graduation. That was not the case for Milton, and it's not the case for MAs generally anywhere else either. Milton worked for his MA, okay? But alongside this, he composed poetry. Christmas Day 1629, he completed one of his most famous poems on the morning of Christ's Nativity. And as Gordon Campbell explains, it was Milton's first poem on a religious theme, and he later indicated its importance in his spiritual and poetic development by placing it first in his 1645 and then in his 1673 poems. Milton's first published work, quite interestingly, came in the second Shakespeare folio of 1632. So he wrote a commendatory poem. And for much of the 1630s, he was diligently studying and composing poetry, much of the time in the countryside just outside London. And it's likely that L'Allegro and Il Penseroso that you've read are from this time. But like several other works, we don't know exactly the date that Milton composed them. Other works that he penned in the 1630s include his famous masque that was performed at Ludlow Castle, commonly known as Comus. And another one of his most famous poems, although I feel like I say every poem is his most famous poem at the moment, the memorial poem Lycidas, composed in memory of his friend from Cambridge, Edward King, who drowned off the coast of Wales. So, the death of his close friend King and the death of his mother saw Milton decide to undertake the sort of grand tour, a common activity for wealthy young men, which saw them travel through Europe visiting key sites of cultural and historical interest. And Milton spent about 15 months away from England, travelling extensively around Europe. So we know he visited Paris, Nice, Genoa, Pisa, Florence, the home of the Renaissance, and he famously, again, overuse of the word in this lecture, famously met Galileo. He went to Siena, he went to Rome, where he stayed for 2 months. Naples, Bologna, Venice, he stayed there for a month, Verona, Milan, and then Lake Geneva and Geneva itself, before travelling back through France and returning back to England. And as I've sort of mentioned already, upon his return, he took up the position of tutor to his sister's children, John and Edward Phillips. But he also returned to an increasingly divided and fractious England, unsettled England. He almost immediately engaged in debates about the episcopacy, which was proving particularly contentious in England at this time. He produced 5 pamphlets known as his anti-prelatical tracts. They emerged between 1637 and 1642. On a side note, but quite interestingly, in 1642 he married for the first time. He was 33 and he chose Mary Powell, who was the 17-year-old daughter of a man he had business dealings with in Oxfordshire. And quite infamously, this marriage was extremely unsuccessful initially. He travelled back from Oxfordshire with her to London, to the house where he was working as a tutor. And she was quickly very unhappy in such a sort of hothouse of academic study. And for all accounts, she appears to have fled as quickly as possible back to Oxfordshire, back to her family. She had asked permission to return until the end of September, but she didn't come back. Possibly partly due to the eruption of the Civil War, and it was increasingly difficult to travel between Oxford and London. Possibly for other reasons. And Milton penned a series of tracts on divorce, arguing for a reform of England's divorce laws. So as I'm sure you know, at this time it was exceptionally hard to get a divorce in England. Grounds for divorce generally rested on adultery or non-consummation. And Milton argued that this really wasn't sufficient. He based his argument around Genesis and argued that, as Campbell states, a man should be able to divorce his wife if the marriage has become spiritually and emotionally barren. A caveat is, perhaps surprisingly, Milton's wife actually did return to him. She did come back. And the second time around, they forged a much more successful relationship and ended up having several children. I'll come back to her in a minute. 1645, this is sort of a whistle-stop tour of Milton's life, really. 1645, Milton collected all of his early poetry and he published it. But by this time, he started to notice that his eyesight was failing. And for about 4 years, he returned to a life of quiet scholarship. But the execution of King Charles I in 1649 saw Milton come back into the public sphere. And ultimately, he would prove to be a central spokesman for the Republican cause. So almost immediately after Charles was executed, Milton became, if you like, the spin doctor of the Commonwealth. He published The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates, which defended the king's trial and execution. And as the newly appointed Secretary of Foreign Tongues, or the Latin Secretary, he was quickly given the crucial job of responding to the popular and emotive pamphlet, which was called Icon Basilica. So this pamphlet quickly whipped up opinion and portrayed Charles as a martyr. And increasingly, people started to think so. It was a very popular pamphlet. It sold, in its first year alone, 35 editions in England and more than 25 in Ireland and on the continent. It was a real threat. People were clamouring to read it. And it kind of... well, from Milton's point of view, it manipulated sentiment and sympathy for Charles, and that was really dangerous for the fledgling republic. So Milton stepped in and he penned Iconoclastes, so the Image Breaker, which sought to repudiate much of the emotive fervour that Icon Basilica had created. But it is worth noting that whilst Icon Basilica went through 35 editions, so more than 50 editions, kind of Europe-wide, Milton's text went through two. So, as you're kind of getting a feeling, Milton's job as secretary was to compose responses to the large number of texts emerging from the continent that kind of spoke against Charles's execution, and he was defending the actions of the Commonwealth and England's newly found republican status. But this was a time of great personal struggle and challenge for Milton. By 1648, he'd lost the sight in his left eye. By 1652, he'd gone completely blind. To kind of compound all of this, his wife Mary, who he'd kind of ultimately forged a successful marriage with, died in May 1652 after giving birth to a daughter, and the daughter quickly followed her to the grave a month later. To add misery on misery, his son, who'd been born in 1651, died six weeks after the death of his wife and daughter. So Milton was blind, he'd lost his wife, he'd lost two infant children, and was left with four living children to look after, alongside his demanding job as the spokesman for the Commonwealth. So Milton found fame and infamy. He was regularly attacked, but he found fame as a prose writer and as a polemicist. But he did continue to write poetry as well. But even his poetry found a political leaning. So he composed sonnets, so the poetry of love. But Milton turned them instead into the poetry of politics. Kind of weaving in his personal life alongside that, he remarried to Catherine Woodcock in November 1656. But again, he lost his wife and their newborn child just a month after the birth of the child in October 1657. So, more broadly speaking, in 1660, Charles II was restored to the throne. And as I'm sure you can understand, Milton's life was in grave danger. He went into hiding. But he eventually emerged, but was quickly then arrested. His books were publicly burnt by the public executioner, but Milton was lucky. And he was released, and he was able to sort of go back to some sort of semblance of a normal life outside of hiding. He marries again, February 1663, so the third and the final wife. By this point, he was 54, and she was called Elizabeth Minchell, and she was just 24. And she outlives him by more than half a century. So it's in this period after the Restoration that Milton started to work solidly on Paradise Lost. He'd had the idea for a tragedy along the same lines, on the same subject matter, as early as 1640, and during his period in hiding and the time in prison, sort of broke up his ability to work on it in any extensive detail on what he had now re-envisioned as an epic poem. But after the dust settled on the Restoration, Milton worked solidly on Paradise Lost. He famously dictated it to an amanuensis, who wrote it down for him. And his nephew, Edward Phillips, who he had tutored, then read the written drafts and checked them before they went to press. So I'm going to talk more extensively about Milton's aims and intentions for Paradise Lost in the later part of the lecture. So I'm going to leave it here, apart from saying that the first three editions of Paradise Lost sold fairly well, but it only came to be recognised as what Campbell terms England's national epic in 1688, when it was published by subscription. And it was published by subscription in a kind of very swanky, gilt-edged folio, and it was read by a who's who of readers. And that propelled Paradise Lost into the realm of England's national epic. So Milton's later writings, he wrote a sequel to Paradise Lost called Paradise Regained. Perhaps, like lots of sequels, never quite captures the success of the first. So that was published in 1671. He also worked on a piece of closet drama, so drama that's intended to be read rather than to be performed, and that was called Samson Agonistes. So the last published work he saw was the second edition of Paradise Lost in 1674, which he'd rearranged from 10 books. So it had initially been structured into 10 books. He rearranged into 12 books to more closely parallel some of the classical works of epic. He did write prose, a Latin primer, a history of Britain, a treatise on logic, but he died at his home on the night of the sort of 9th, 10th of November 1674, having lived an astonishing life full of learning and creativity and controversy. So that's a whistle-stop tour of Milton's life, crammed into 20 minutes or so. The rest of the lecture is going to focus more on poetry. And to talk about and contextualise the poetry that I asked you to read in advance of the session. So it's here that I'm going to try to bring out some of the ways in which Milton engaged with the classical world in his poetry, starting by looking at the two early poems by Milton that I gave you, so L'Allegro and Il Penseroso. So a brief recap of the kind of historical context behind Milton's composition of the poems, before turning to show you how Milton used the classical, both in terms of genre and in terms of imagery. Okay. So if you'll forgive me, we'll jump back to the 1630s and think a little bit briefly about context. Milton had left Cambridge. He began this period of lengthy study, which was marked by a relatively large poetic output, and importantly to note, a relatively large vernacular poetic output. So before he composed On the Morning of Christ's Nativity in 1629, Milton had a clear preference for composing in languages other than English. So prior to 1629, he'd written one poem in Greek, 6 poems in Italian, 19 in Latin, and just 7 in English. And of those 7, 3 of those were actually translations. But during this kind of period of poetic outpouring in the 1630s, we see a marked shift in Milton's choice of language. And between 1629 and the composition of Lycidas in 1637-38, Milton wrote just 2 poems in Latin. And 2 of the vernacular poems to emerge from Milton's pen in the 1630s were L'Allegro and Il Penseroso, so the lively man, the reflective man, which, as Gordon Teskey nicely frames it, wander through their landscapes, observing, listening, delighting, reflecting, and choosing. So hopefully we're going to pick apart these poems together a little bit in the seminar. So I'm going to focus on introducing you to a key classical genre that Milton employs, particularly for l'allegro, and which was the foundation stone that set Milton off on a career trajectory akin to that of the great Roman poet Virgil. And that genre is pastoral. Okay. So the first pastoral poet was the Greek Theocritus, who in his Idylls presented, as Barbara Lewalski explains, the imagined lives and activities and poems of shepherds, goatherds, and other country folk. His subjects include singing contests and wagers, a day-long harvest festival, and the joys and tribulations of love. Virgil follows Theocritus and famously continued and expanded the idea of the pastoral in his eclogues. Like Milton, Virgil wrote pastoral poetry early on in his career, and it was common in the Renaissance to include in the opening of the Aeneid, so Virgil's great epic poem, Virgil's account of how he progressed from pastoral to Georgic to epic, a career trajectory that Milton was also to follow. Pastoral was in vogue for much of the Renaissance in England, particularly in Elizabethan England. So Edmund Spenser particularly famously made the genre his own. By the time Milton started to write pastoral poetry in the 1630s, its sort of fashionable moment had passed. But as a learned, studious and classically grounded poet who was clearly modelling his future career on those of the classical poets, it's unsurprising that Milton chose to write in the genre. Whilst both poems resemble, as Lewalski explains, a classical hymn celebrating an allegorical deity, so for l'allegro it's mirth, or euphrosyne, and for Il Penseroso it's the goddess melancholy, the more overtly pastoral of the two is definitely l'allegro. But what makes it pastoral? A variety of images, tropes and characters that Milton employs echo those of the classical pastoral, updated to a rustic and rural English countryside. For example, we see rural folk and fairy tales, songs in the Lydian mode, so a kind of mode of ancient Greek music. And we see it in the activities of characters, inherently pastoral characters, shepherds and shepherdesses, who do typical kind of activities that you would encounter in classical pastoral, the day-to-day of countryside life, farming and watching and engaging with nature, as well as happy socialising within a rustic and countryside setting. So why did Milton choose to compose a classically pastoral poem like l'allegro? Well, I've already mentioned it mimicked the career pattern of ancient poets, who started with pastoral and culminated with epic poetry. And Milton fully intended to do this when the time presented itself. He fully intended to write an epic poem. Also, because in the Renaissance it was commonly accepted that pastoral was kind of the lowest form of poetry, and as Lewalski explains, it was therefore kind of an appropriate starting point for a young poet. But it's not just on the level of genre that Milton evoked and used the classical past to help create the world of l'allegro, but as you'll have noticed, the poem is a tissue of classical references, people, ideas and places from the world of classical mythology. I'm going to unpack one in particular for you that particularly exemplifies how Milton utilised and made his own mythological imagery. So I hasten to add that I'm indebted to the work of someone else for this. So Charles Grosvenor Osgood and his very detailed study of classical mythology in Milton's poetry. So he brings to the fore something you may have noticed, the abundance of sound and colour that comes across in l'allegro. And he very nicely links Milton's use of classical mythology to the prevalence of the strikingly visual and oral, sort of aural, nature of the poem. It stems, he argues, from Milton's unusual and uncommon establishing of the origin and parentage of the central figure of Mirth, who Milton explains is the daughter of the mythological figures Zephyr and Aurora. You see behind me the best images I could find. So this isn't the usual explanation of Mirth's parentage, but Osgood argues this is a deliberate choice on Milton's part to create a world of colour and sound. So by having Mirth's mother be Aurora, the goddess of the dawn, and inherently associated with bright colours, Milton therefore imbues Mirth with inherited colour. Note the vivid description of Murph's conception on the bed of blue violets and first blown roses. So by tweaking the usual mythology, Milton's created an inherently colourful character. And he does the same to create a very oral poem. One where sounds are very important. So remember the prevalence of sounds as much as colour. You get the lark, the cockerel, the hounds, the horns, the whistles, and the songs. And as Osgood states, this stems from Murph's father, who's Zephyr, who, whilst Aurora conjures up a world of colour, he conjures up a world of sound. So Milton notes numerous times the sound of the west wind, Zephyr, through the poem. Consequently, the central goddess in this poem is imbued through her unusual parentage with the qualities of sound and colour. And as Osgood explains, this shows, and I quote, how the poet has adapted certain conceptions from mythology and has informed the poem throughout with their spirit. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say for the early poetry, kind of treading a line between kind of giving you contextual information and some information on the poems, but not sort of covering too much and not leaving us very much to discuss. So I'll leave the early poems there, and I'll start to talk about Paradise Lost and epic poetry. So I wasn't given a brief beforehand, and I'm presuming that people haven't necessarily read Paradise Lost. I'm not sure. Some people may not. So I've gone with people haven't read it. That was the easy. I wasn't going to presume knowledge. I felt like my first job before I talked about Paradise Lost in any kind of poetical way, or before I even talked about epic poetry, was to give you a kind of brief plot overview of Paradise Lost, to tell you what happens. So I'll do that first. From there, I'm going to give you a quick overview of the history of epic poetry up to Milton, and then another whistle-stop tour of the key features of what is a very formulaic genre of epic poetry. So I'm going to tell you kind of some of the key features to look out for. And then the final bit of the lecture, I'm going to talk about how Milton adapts classical epic when he composes his biblical epic, Paradise Lost. And then we're going to break for tea. So, basically, Paradise Lost deals with the fall of man, okay? It's Genesis expanded. That's quite reductive. But if you know Genesis, you will know roughly what's going on in Paradise Lost, okay? So, it's split into 12 books. Initially 10 books, and Milton then expands them to 12 books. And I'll talk you through the 12-book structure and tell you sort of very briefly what happens in each book. So, book one, we start in media res, so in the middle of things. And I'm going to come back to that term, a sort of key term for epic poetry. So in media res, in the middle of things. So we start by meeting Satan and the fallen rebel angels in hell. Okay, that is book one. Book two, Satan assembles a council of rebel angels and they decide what they're going to do next. And their plan of action is that Satan should go and explore the newly created earth that they heard God talk about. Book three, we meet God and the sun, always referred to as God and the sun. We meet them for the first time, and God prophesies the fall of man, but he explains to the sun that he gave Adam and Eve free will, right? He gave them free will to stand or fall as they chose. So he predicts, right? He knows mankind is going to fall, and the sun offers himself to save mankind. Also in book three, we see Satan arrive at Earth. So he's travelled from hell to Earth. Book four, Satan enters Eden, and we meet Adam and Eve, and Satan spies on them. And interestingly, expresses very strong emotions. He has very strong feelings when he sees Adam and Eve in Eden, particularly jealousy. He's jealous of them. But when he's spying on them, he's caught. He's caught by one of God's good angels, and he's expelled from Eden. So, book five, the angel Raphael goes to Eden to warn Adam and Eve that Satan is up to no good. And Raphael then relates the story of the war in heaven between Satan and, so then Lucifer, and God. And he relates that just to Adam. So, book six. Sorry, it's from the bottom there. Basically, Raphael carries on, right? We get more information, astonishing information, about the war in heaven. Book seven, Raphael describes the creation of the world to Adam. Book eight, he describes the creation of Adam and Eve. And book nine is the fall. Satan comes back to Eden, and he disguises himself as a serpent, and he tempts Eve with the apple from the tree of knowledge. He tempts her with knowledge. She eats the apple and falls, and Adam quickly follows her. Book 10, we see God judge Adam and Eve, and the allegorical figures of sin and death, who have been the gatekeepers to hell until now, they build a bridge between earth and hell, and sin and death enter earth for the first time. Satan goes back to hell and he tells the rebel angels of his success, but God quickly punishes them and turns them into snakes. Book 11, Michael is sent to Eden to expel Adam and Eve, but before he does that, he shows Adam the future. He takes him up to the top of a mountain and he shows Adam the future. In book 11, he shows him the future up until the flood. And book 12, Michael shows Adam more of the future, and then Adam and Eve leave paradise forever, and they very nicely leave hand in hand. So, that's a reductionist overview of one of the lengthy poems in the English language. But it was important for you to kind of know some of the very general, if I can say the very general nuances of what Milton does with Paradise Lost. So now I'm going to quickly give you some information about the history of epic poetry up to Milton, and then tell you some of the component parts that make up the poetic genre of epic. Okay. So, a brief history of epic poetry prior to Milton. So, important to note, Paradise Lost was published first in 1667. So the European epic tradition really began with Homer and his two famous epics, the Iliad, which deals with the Trojan War, and the Odyssey, which deals with Odysseus's lengthy journey home from the Trojan War. And it's important to note these were oral poems and they were sung.
Sung.
From ancient Greece, we move to ancient Rome and we join the Roman poet Virgil, who composes his epic poem, the Aeneid, which deals with Aeneas's journey from Troy to ultimately founding Rome. And it's important to note that it was Virgil rather than Homer who was generally considered in the Renaissance to be the greatest epic poet. Although there are several academics who would say that Milton's favourite epic poet or favourite poet would be Homer. But generally in the Renaissance, Virgil is privileged as the greatest epic poet. That's partly to do with the kind of history of the transmission of these epic stories. Because Homer's works were lost to the West from late antiquity until the 14th century. So it was the Aeneid rather than the Iliad or the Odyssey that was really read extensively throughout the Middle Ages. In the Renaissance, unsurprisingly, given the precedence that's given to classical writing, and hopefully unsurprisingly for you now, I've given you some more context about the kind of education that poets received, lots and lots of people attempted to write epic poetry. And as the critic Gregory explains, this crowded literary landscape presented Milton with many potential models, but it was more crowded with failures than successes. So lots of people tried, not many people succeeded. The most famous and well-regarded epic poem in English before Paradise Lost is Edmund Spenser's The Faery Queen. So a chivalric epic that uses allegory and an Arthurian setting to celebrate the reign of Elizabeth I. So they're the broad brushstrokes of the big epics and the big epic poets that influenced Milton when he comes to write Paradise Lost. But the final bit of the lecture, possibly the most important bit of the lecture, what is epic poetry? Epic poems are are very basically long narrative poems that generally tell the story of a major event. So usually of national, or in Milton's case, universal importance. So in the case of the epics that you looked at in preparation for today, they deal with the Trojan War, so in the case of the Iliad. In the Aeneid, the poem deals with the founding of Rome. Paradise Lost deals with the fall of man. The style of an epic poem is elevated, it's dignified, and there are a number of poetic features that you expect to see in epic poetry. So the first one is epic poetry makes great use of extensive and detailed description. So you'll often get extensive lists. So anyone who knows the Iliad, the famous catalogue of ships, which recounts all of the Greeks who travelled to Troy to fight to regain Helen of Troy after she was stolen / ran away from her husband Menelaus with Paris. Another example of extensive and detailed description is very vivid and very detailed descriptions of objects of importance. And this is known as ekphrasis. Famously, again from the Iliad, the shield of Achilles is described in an ekphrastic way. So we get an extensive description of a variety of scenes on Achilles' shield that depict past and future events. So the shield has been open to interpretation. No one's 100% certain exactly what it represents. Generally, it's considered to kind of represent all of humanity, all of civilization, right? So one shield represents everything. That's an example of kind of ekphrasis. Another formal feature of epics are epic similes, okay? Which I found a definition for you. The Poetry Foundation defines as a detailed, often complex, poetic comparison that unfolds over the course of several lines. So, and I've kind of picked examples, in this case from Paradise Lost. Book one in particular, and so there are various books. Milton has a preference for epic similes in some books more than others, and the first few books of Paradise Lost have a real prevalence of epic similes in them. One of the most famous is the description of Satan lying on the burning lake in hell. So I'm going to read it out to you. So, thus Satan, talking to his nearest mate with head uplift above the wave and eyes that sparkling blazed, his other parts beside prone on the flood, extended long and large, lay floating many a rood in bulk as huge as whom the fable's name of monstrous size. Titanian or earthborn that warred on Jove, Briareus or Typhon, whom the den by ancient Tarsus held, or that sea beast Leviathan, which god of all his works created hugest that swim the ocean stream. Him haply slumbering on the Norway foam, the pilot of some small night-founded skiff, deeming some island, often as seamen tell, with fixed anchor in his scaly rind, moors by his side under the lee, while night invests the sea and wished morn delays. So stretched out huge in length, the arch-fiend lay, chained on the burning lake. Okay, so this epic simile paints a really vivid picture of Satan's size, how big he is. He's as big as the Titans, who famously fought against the Olympian gods. He's as big as the sea monster Leviathan. And from Leviathan, Milton, as he often does with epic similes, extends them, right? He pushes them further than Homer or Virgil. So from Leviathan, Milton then associates Satan with a giant sea monster, or whale, who's so large that sailors mistake him for an island and they try to moor up on him. Equally, towards the end of book one, the rebel angels assemble for the great council in hell, and Milton describes them via an epic simile. He describes them as being like bees. Okay. So the following quote, I've read more than the epic simile, just to kind of foreground a little bit of the situation, but I'll kind of flag up when we get to the epic simile. So, meanwhile, the winged heralds by command of sovereign power, with awful ceremony and trumpet sound throughout the host proclaim, a solemn council forthwith to be held at Pandemonium, the high capital of Satan and his peers. Their summons called from every band and square and regiment, by place or choice the worthiest. They anon, with hundreds and with thousands, trooping came, attended. All access was thronged, the gates and porches wide, but the chief, the spacious hall, though like a covered field where champions bold would ride in armed and at the soldan's chair, defied the best of Paynim chivalry to mortal combat or career with lance. Thick swarmed both on the ground and in the air, brushed with the hiss of rustling wings, enter epic simile, as bees in springtime when the sun with Taurus rides, pour forth their populous youth above the hive in clusters. They among fresh dews and flowers fly to and fro, or on the smoothed plank, the suburb of their straw-built citadel, new rubbed with balm, expatiate and confer their state affairs. So thick the airy crowd swarmed and was straitened. So, as I've already said, Milton has a tendency to expand and build on his epic similes. As John Broadbent noted, Milton's similes are more frequent, longer, and more complex, and more meaningful than those of any other epic poet. So, before I move on to talk a little bit more about Milton's use and adaptation of epic, there are two more important features of epic poetry that I need to kind of flag. Firstly, it's the invocation to a muse, which you will have seen as partly why I gave you the kind of opening the opening lines of all of those epics. So the use of invocations to a muse where the poet seeks divine aid and inspiration. So, oh, sorry, I didn't get my slide. So the Iliad, sing goddess, the anger of Peleus' son Achilles and its devastation, which put pain's thousandfold upon the Achaeans. The opening of the Odyssey, tell me muse of the man of many ways who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. As you'll have noticed, Virgil takes a little bit longer to invoke the muse in the Aeneid, but he still does so within the first 20 lines of the poem. So the opening lines, I sing of warfare and a man at war. From the seacoast of Troy in early days, he came to Italy by destiny to our Lavinian western shore, a fugitive. This captain buffeted cruelly on land as on the sea by blows from powers of the air. Behind them, baleful Juno in her sleepless rage, and cruel losses were his lot in war, till he could found a city and bring home his gods to Latium, land of the Latin race, the Alban lords and the high walls of Rome. Tell me the causes now, O muse, how galled in her divine pride and how sore at heart from her old wound, the Queen of Gods compelled him, a man apart, devoted to his mission, to undergo so many perilous days and enter on so many trials. And Milton, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse, that on the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai didst inspire that shepherd who first taught the chosen seed in the beginning of how the heavens and the earth rose out of chaos. So I'm not going to talk any more about invoking the muse, as I think this is something that we're probably going to do together in the seminar half of this evening's session. I'll finish this overview of epic poetry and its features with a continuation of thinking about epic openings, by saying it's important to note that another key feature of epic poetry, and I've already mentioned it, is that it begins in what we call in media res, in the middle of things. So epic poems start in the middle of the story. The poet gradually fills you in on what has happened as the narrative progresses. So the Iliad, the epic poem of the Trojan War, begins 10 years into the Trojan War. In Paradise Lost, the story of the fall of man opens after the rebel angels led by Satan have been banished from heaven and have ended up on the burning lake in hell. We join them midway through the action and we only hear about the war in heaven later, much later in the poem. Okay, so hopefully now you'll kind of be aware of some of the formulaic features of epic poetry. And the last little bit, the last kind of 5 minutes, I'm going to talk specifically about what Milton does with the epic form in Paradise Lost and situate it within the context of writing, of composing poetry in the Renaissance. So I've mentioned several times that Milton planned for a long time to write a work of epic poetry, considered in the Renaissance to be the highest form of literature. Sir Philip Sidney said, the best and most accomplished kind of poetry. And Milton incorporates all of the hallmarks of epic poetry in Paradise Lost. Epic similes, beginning in media res, catalogues, gods and men, I didn't mention those, you get meddling gods interfering with men's lives in epic. a central and important plot, ekphrasis, everything that I've spent the last 10 minutes talking about. But what I think is most striking and what is the most interesting and successful aspect of Paradise Lost is that it uses the classical form of epic to convey a biblical story and message. It's a Christian story. The goal of Paradise Lost is to, and I quote, justify the ways of God to men. That's what Milton wants to do. It deals with humanity, not with England, not with Rome, not with ancient Greece. And Milton says outright on several occasions in his poem that he knows he's doing something new. He famously says, things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme. And in Book 9, that what he is doing is not less but more heroic than the classical epics of old. So he's being very modest about his poetry here. But Milton doesn't simply take a classical genre and then write in a purely Christian style, but he skillfully and beautifully weaves the classical and the Christian together. As Blessington argues, every aspect of the poem gains force by being set beside the Homeric and Virgilian tradition. And then he gives a lovely analogy that nicely sums up how Milton uses his classical precursors. He says, Milton built his epic out of those of Homer and Virgil, like a cathedral erected out of the ruins of pagan temples whose remains can still be seen. So, to kind of bring the lecture to a close, I'm going to return back to Milton's classical education in order to explain why Milton does this. It's all to do with the education that Milton received, that I filled you in on already, and what expectations and procedures that created amongst Renaissance poets. Remember, Milton's education was based on translation of, engagement with, and imitation of the classics. And this spills over into the literary outputs of men in the Renaissance. As Charles Martindale explains, it was the habit of Renaissance poets to incorporate their works, which are in effect passages of free translation of classical poetry, or even on occasion, prose. In doing so, they were carrying over into adult life what they had been taught to do as schoolboys. But this in itself was based on classical precedent. He continues, Renaissance theorists, like the critics of antiquity, laid considerable stress on the imitation of earlier poetry. It was grounded in ancient precedent, thus Virgil had imitated Homer and Cicero Demosthenes. Rightly conducted, it was not plagiarism, partly because there was no attempt to conceal the source of the borrowing, and only partly because the process was not one of stale copying, but of a creative adaptation of old material to a new context and purpose. And I hope the session after tea is really going to bring to light, via a close reading of these epic openings, of the ways in which Milton was doing just this with Paradise Lost. Yes, Milton adopted the classical genre of epic. Yes, Milton copied many elements, motifs, turns of phrase, poetic formulas and techniques from Homer and Virgil, but he definitively made it his own. In doing all of that, but writing about the fall of man, Milton created an astonishingly vivid and original piece of poetry that now sees him put on the same pedestal as Homer and Virgil. So, as I said, I've tried to tread a careful line in this lecture to give you enough background information to make the next bit of the session more comprehensible, but not to give too much information away, to ensure that we can do some close reading and some close analysis as a group, to figure out how Milton adopted, used, and modified the classical tradition in his poetry. So thank you for listening for 55 minutes, and I'm looking forward to sort of cracking on with some group discussions after we've had some tea and biscuits. Thank you very much. Apologies for conveying so much information in such a short period of time. I don't know what knowledge you have, so I felt like I should just try and give you as much of it as possible. We can sort of hopefully have quite an interesting discussion in the next hour.
Yeah, I am.
How's it going? Dare I ask?
depends. Yeah, it's an exciting point of view. The final months, I was just sort of between the thesis and what's next. And so it's just a bit overwhelming, but the thesis itself is becoming more and more enjoyable. So.
Oh, this is, yeah.